Hello, everybody, and welcome to, well, I would say a live stream because we were thinking of doing this as a live stream for our members. But Tom, the Australian Wi-Fi rather disappointed us, didn't it?
It did.
So we're doing this as an extended bonus edition of The Rest Is History.
So we're in Brisbane at the moment in Australia, and we checked out the Wi-Fi yesterday, and it kind of very temperamental. And then we thought we got it working, but it just kept cutting out. And so we didn't want to risk you all turning up, tuning in, and then us not being able to do it. So huge apologies.
And I know people often like a glimpse into the behind the scenes world of The Rest Is History. So just to give you a sense of the sheer glamour of our lifestyles, we have barricaded ourselves into a hotel room in Brisbane. We have Theo with us, our producer, and Dom, who is our erstwhile producer. And they have basically barricaded the entrance, claiming to reduce echo and close curtains. And it doesn't feel sinister at all, does it?
Well, it looks like a scene from the Watergate.
It does.
We're up to kind of CIA agents up to no good.
Yeah. So to the theme of today's episode, we've obviously recently been doing these episodes about the fall of the Aztecs. And we're talking about this one particular moment when Cortez met Montezuma, which is the subject of a brilliant book by Matthew Restall, just on this thing that he calls the meeting, in capital letters, which, as we've said, is one of the absolute seismic landmark moments in world history. Because
iconic moment.
Yeah, an iconic moment. It's become a sort of avatar, an embodiment of European colonialism and the meeting between the old world and the new. And that set us thinking, didn't it, Tom?
It did.
Of what moments we would, you know, if you were trying to instruct an alien, and you said, these are the moments in human history that stand for the whole sweep. What would we choose?
The whole of humanity.
Yeah, for the whole of humanity. So the Battle of Cressy.
And Gene Shrimpton going to Derby Day at Melbourne.
Yeah.
Which we've nominated as the two most significant events in world history, haven't we?
Yeah, and Wolves inventing Europe.
I knew you'd do that joke. So none of those have made the cut. But shall we crack on and reveal our first one?
This is yours, Tom. You talk about this one. You speak about this one.
So this is the invention of fire, or at least rather not the invention of fire, but humanity learning to control fire. It's a difficult one because it must have happened quite a lot of times, because I imagine that out in the bush, Dominic, there's lightning, fire spreads, and our ancient ancestors, or at least early hominins who may not necessarily have been our direct ancestors, might have controlled it, used it to kind of kill animals and then eat them, used the kind of the charred ashes to then light fires themselves. But obviously the precise dates for this are very difficult to pin down.
But we must have some rough idea how many tens of thousands of years ago or whatever. Oh,
I mean, people talk in terms of millions. I mean, might have been a million or more years ago that hominins were starting to use fire. I mean, the question of when people are able to light fire themselves, kind of using flints
matches
or whatever. Yeah, matches, lighters, cigarette lighters. That's more contested. But we know that hominins are... And by hominins, I mean people who are not Homo sapiens.
Yeah, I wanted to know what that meant.
It's a type of Homo.
Right.
So the class of creature that we belong to.
Okay.
Human being.
Like Homo erectus and so on.
Yeah. Or Homo neanderthalensis, or Homo ergaster, the worker.
Right.
So all these kind of various hominins, of which there seem to have been far more than people realized, certainly when I was a child, kind of roaming around, getting out their lighters. But people are using... So I mean, it's very ironic. 300,000 years ago, a great pile of flints were being made and sharpened in fire, so to use for war. So war in the Holy Land has a very long backstory. But at the same time, people are presumably using it to cook. And there are lots of grandiose claims made for the significance of this, that cooking is what enables human brains to expand.
Really? Is that true?
I don't know.
A man who
it's not the rest of science.
So
we keep
somebody
saying
who lives on sushi or kind of a raw food diet,
that cooked meat gives you a lot more bang for your buck in terms of energy.
Okay.
And we've been eating very well in Australia, haven't we? So our brains should be massively expanded.
Well, that's a very
as a result of this.
I mean,
talk.
Tom, that's a brave thing for you to say, given your intermittent vegetarianism. You're now endorsing cooked meat.
Yeah. Well, I think I mean, this is obviously why it's a little bit controversial. I mean, I would in no way claim to be particularly knowledgeable about this, but it is a very respected theory and one that is contested. But we've sent out a whole load of photographs to accompany this, which went out on the email, announcing the cancellation of the live show. So you may or may not see them. I mean, it's not vital, but perhaps a little visual background. And we have included in that a load of guys around a fire, the Flints from Israel 300,000 years ago, and the iconic scene from Space Odyssey where
2001,
yeah. where the apes gather around and they see the monolith, and bingo,
yeah,
they are launched on a course that will culminate in space travel. And you could say that I think that the discovery of fire is that perhaps that kind of monolith moment.
Well, why have you chosen this rather than the invention of farming?
Because I think that fire long precedes it, mm-hmm. and that the roots of what makes Homo sapiens, in particular Homo sapiens, reach far back before the invention of farming.
Okay.
And it's clearly what distinguishes hominins, and since it's history rather than anthropology discussion, yeah. or paleontology discussion, we're talking about human beings. It's what distinguishes us, one of the key things that distinguishes us from other creatures and enables us to create history.
Right, let's have the next one, Tom. This is another one that you chose, although I endorse this one.
So you're not endorsing fire?
I don't give a damn about fire, to be brutally honest with you, because I don't like prehistory.
Okay, but you'd accept, but I mean, even if you don't like prehistory, you'd accept that
I intellectually,
things that happened in prehistory are important for...
Intellectually, I accept it.
Yeah, fine,
but, good. But emotionally, okay, well, I'm emotionally, I feel it's not as important as the Battle of Cressy. So let's go for number two, which is the... So this is about the state and about authority. It's about power, oppression, but it's also about humans' ability to manipulate their environment, I suppose, to some degree. And yeah. this is the Great Pyramid at
construction
Giza.
Of the Great Pyramid in Giza. And if you see the email, you'll see a lovely photograph that I took when I was filming there, and a picture of me pointing the Sphinx. So that's great fun. And we've chosen the Great Pyramid out of all the monuments that kind of symbolize the emergence, well, of what you're talking about, of agriculture,
yeah.
which then enable surpluses to be built up, which then enable hierarchies and priests and kings to emerge, these great empires. And I think the Great Pyramid is iconic, partly because it's so immense, but also because it survived.
Right.
And people have been visiting it, gawping at it, wondering about it ever since.
The only one of the seven wonders of the world to survive, is that correct? The ancient seven wonders of the world.
Yeah. I mean, of course, people might think we're explaining iconic moments in human history to aliens, that it is perhaps a Eurocentric perspective, because the list of the great wonders of the world, seven great wonders of the world, were drawn up by Greeks.
Yeah.
But I think that even if you were in China or Mesoamerica, where of course there were also incredible wonders and buildings, I think even there people would accept that the Great Pyramid is the ultimate symbol.
So the Great Pyramid, give us a little bit of a bluffer's guide, Tom. Built when and by whom?
Built around 2500 BC by a pharaoh that the Greeks called Cheops. I think we're going to do some episodes on the pyramids, are we not? We're planning to maybe go to Egypt and even have a look at them.
that's like one of the episodes for 2029 or something.
But I think
probably.
In terms of the reason why it's iconic, it's just expressive of the kind of the future course that human civilization will take, in that humans' ability to compile things that are in excess of their simple, most basic needs are what enable everything that we enjoy today to exist.
But it's more than that, isn't it, though? The Great Pyramid, built by, if not slave labor, then...
No, it's not slave labor. It's kind of Keynesian project.
Right.
So it...
Public works.
It's kind of public work. So you keep... So essentially, everybody gets involved in it, and it keeps the economy ticking over.
But it must be, to some degree, it's a symbol of inequality. So it's built to,
massively.
You know, to memorialize a pharaoh.
Or to be his tomb.
Yeah, exactly. But the point is, because it's his tomb, it's also, to some degree, a symbol of history. It's a symbol of remembering, mm-hmm. and trying to, you know, to leave visible physical markers for those human beings who have gone. So it can stand in a way for the whole sweep of history. But it's also a symbol of collective organization and state power, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, you said about public works.
Yes.
So without the things that you talked about, fire and farming, without organization, without record keeping, without authority, you would have no pyramids.
Yeah. And I think that that today, as people have been doing since at least the time of Herodotus, who's the first person we know who writes about it.
Yeah.
People have been wondering why were they built? Because essentially it's hardware from which the software has been erased. And I think that we can admire it as an expression of what humans have been capable of doing, and also kind of ponder and be perplexed by it. And, you know, people back in antiquity saw it as a structure that embodied truths about the gods. Then people have thought that through much of the Middle Ages and into the modern period that it encoded ancient wisdom. Mm. It's an enduring fantasy that today that they were built by aliens or by people from Atlantis. So there's a feeling about them that they, in some way, the meaning is in excess of what we know about how human states function.
Right.
And I think that is also kind of important part of why they're iconic, that humans have repeatedly created things that, if you know nothing about the motives or reasons why they were created, will bewilder other humans.
Yeah. So hence the pyramids as you said, of Central America, let's say, or the, what about the Great Wall of China? I was thinking about the Great Wall of China as one of the only monuments that really rivals the pyramids in terms of international recognition, I would say. The Colosseum, I suppose, as well.
I guess a large wall built to keep people out is pretty explicable. I mean, anyone who has any notion of property, the idea of land as something that belongs to someone, would immediately understand that. Whereas I think a pyramid, or indeed the Colosseum, or indeed a cathedral, if you know nothing about the culture that produces it, would be bewildering.
Yeah, okay. So the pyramids kind of stand for the generations of temples, mosques, churches, cathedrals that come after.
Not entirely, because we are going to come on to our third iconic moment. Of course we are.
So do you want to go on to your third one, Tom?
So number three is, and there may be a kind of collective groan from every club member who's listening to this.
Yeah, Tom and Theo in the room are looking, heads and hands, absolute heads and hands moment.
But I have chosen Constantine seeing the cross. at the Milvian Bridge.
I wish people could hear the sigh. They're like, the weary, resigned sigh from
Dominic,
the producers.
I mean, you know, you would agree with me. I mean, you've passed this. I mean, you would accept that.
I passed it. I don't get a choice, just to be absolutely clear. I passed it. I just couldn't be bothered to argue.
So this is the literally iconic moment when Constantine is outside Rome by the Milvian Bridge.
Yeah.
He has a vision of a cross in the sky. He's told, with this sign, you will conquer. And
he's fighting, is it Maxentius?
Yes, but that's a detail that in the context is relatively unimportant.
That's important.
Because what matters is the fusion of a great empire with what will come to be called a religion, in this case, Christianity. Mm-hmm. But it sets the template for the other great, what will prove to be the great global civilizational way of understanding humanity's relationship to the divine, which is Islam. And between them, Christianity and Islam have done more, I think, than any other ideologies to shape the way that humans have functioned and continue to function. So on the photographs, we've got a picture of Constantine seeing his sign. We've got the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. Yeah. And Jerusalem, of course, the Holy Land, holy to Jews, to Christians, and to Muslims, is, as we record this, in the eye of a great global storm that is agitating passions, you know, to an extraordinary degree. We were in Melbourne and we saw a kind of great pro-Palestinian demonstration going on there at the opposite end of the world. And I've also included a photograph of a city that we're going to very shortly, Adelaide, which is known as the city of the churches. They have so many churches there.
Yeah.
So the impact of Islam and Christianity has reached even to the continent that we're in at the moment, which is at the kind of the far end of the world from the heartlands of Christianity and Islam.
The interesting thing about this, so Constantine seeing the vision of the cross, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I'm speaking for quite a lot of listeners to the podcast who will say, this is the first iconic moment we've chosen that didn't happen. So,
well, you don't know that it didn't happen.
I think it's plausible, unless you're like one of our vicar members or something, and even some of them might be a bit skeptical, Tom, that there is, whether Constantine genuinely saw this vision in the sky, it's to be debated. So in a way, that makes it a good choice, because it's also about the slipperiness of memory, about the way humans construct stories, about their own history, about the way in which history is kind of retrofitted, all of those kinds of things. Because if it's presumably plausible that Constantine didn't see the vision, but for ideological reasons, it became important to tell the story that he did, right?
I would guess, I mean, I'm sure he thought that he saw it. I think it's exceedingly improbable that he just kind of magicked it up.
At that point, was he a Christian? No.
Well, he doesn't really know what being a Christian is.
Yeah.
But I agree that again, this is why I think it's iconic and why it would be useful for aliens, that stuff that people might be skeptical about, so the existence of gods or visions or wonders or whatever, that these are and have been fundamental in explaining why humans are the way they are.
Yeah. And the other element of this is that obviously in the long run, it leads to the fusion. I mean, you said at this point, people wouldn't really have the idea of religion, of a religion. In the long run, this leads to the fusion of state, or well, an interesting relationship, let's say, a complicated relationship between state authority and what we would now regard as religious belief, right?
I mean, I think that's been there right the way from the beginning. I mean, that's what the pyramid is an embodiment of that idea. I think in the long run, what is distinctive about Christianity is that actually it does, the way that it evolves in Western Europe, it does start to set up a kind of a distinction between what we would call religion and what we would today call the secular.
Yeah.
That Western power has then exported around the world.
Yeah.
So that's a further way in which I think this is an important incident. But in terms of the Middle Ages, the model that Islam and Christianity embodies of powerful states that identify themselves with the power of a single unitary God is, I think, a seismic development. And kind of is self-evidently very effective in a Darwinian way in kind of conquering other ways of understanding.
Because even when you get to the 20th century and you have nominally atheist states, they themselves are similarly devoted to a single creed with prophets, with sacred texts.
Well, because particularly in the communist form, I mean, this is clearly a kind of bastardized descendant of Christianity.
Yeah. Okay. Jolly good. I like that one. And our number four is something that we've done before on The Rest is History, isn't it?
And it's kind of adjacent to how we began this by talking about Moctezuma and Cortez. But if we get rid of Moctezuma and Cortez, what would we have?
So we're in 1492, and this is the moment that Columbus makes landfall in the Caribbean, in the New World. And it stands for, to me, it stands for two things. One, obviously, is the process of colonialism, of colonization. Now, of course, so controversial, but undoubtedly massively important. Tom loves his photo, so he's turning his iPad around.
Dominic, you've chosen a brilliant photo. So we've got an entirely conventional one of Columbus with the Santa Maria, but we also have a brilliant one that you found of Columbus taking a selfie.
Yeah, AI generated. So somebody did these historical selfies. They're very funny. And this is kind of Columbus with his crew. So Columbus looks very jolly there and very heroic, but of course Columbus has now been, to some degree, he's been cancelled, hasn't he? He's very controversial. And that too is an interesting reflection of the way we argue about history. So the story stands in for a bigger thing. But the other photo that we chose is a photo just of a load of tomatoes. And of course, the Columbian Exchange is absolutely monumental in human history. So this is the point. We talked about this a little bit in the Columbus series, and then again a little bit in the Fall of the Aztecs. This is the point at which you get this exchange of viruses, of plants, of foods, of customs, of ideas, all these kinds of things, of people between the Americas. It's not just between the Americas and Europe. So that's the fascinating thing. There's a brilliant, brilliant book by a guy called Charles Seaman called 1493. He wrote one called 1491, which is about the world before Columbus, and 1493, the world after. And in 1493, he has absolutely fascinating stuff. And I speak as somebody who, as you know, Tom, is not a massive admirer of science. He has this really interesting stuff about the scientific and the kind of economic and technological and kind of almost botanical consequences of the flow, not just from Europe to the Americas, but to the Philippines, to India, to China, about the globalization that Columbus's voyages and the Spanish expansion open up. And I think it's one of those things that you learn about at school, and it'd be very entertaining to kind of debunk it and to say, oh, well, actually, most people listen to The Sound of Music. But in this case, I don't think you can debunk it, can you, Tom? Don't you agree that it's an absolutely central...
Absolutely. And I think also the brilliant photo of Columbus with his taking the selfie, I mean, that points to where we are at the moment. We are from the opposite end of the world in Australia, that humans like to travel, that tourism and travel today is a massive, massive industry. Mm-hmm. But equally, going right the way back to the beginnings, going back to fire and everything, I mean, this is something that human history is global because humans have always traveled. And the I mean, it's absolutely true that most humans, for most of history, have not traveled at all. Most humans have kind of lived and died in the same spot. And yet the impulse to kind of venture forwards for good and bad is absolutely what makes why we can talk about global history. And it's why, for instance, we've just been to New Zealand. And the Maori there came to New Zealand not that long before, in global terms, you know, in historical terms, before Europeans arrived there.
Yeah.
That impulse is not the, we think of the Age of Discovery as being purely European, but you think of the way that humans spread across the Pacific Ocean, the Polynesian adventurers as well. I mean, kind of astonishing story.
All of that said, what Columbus's voyages do is they open up an age in which, in a single generation, a single lifetime, you can have, as we have, because this year we've done shows in the United States, done them in Australia, New Zealand, you can have a genuinely global experience in a way that was not open to anybody really, unless you're kind of Ibn Battuta or something.
No, but even then you're not familiar with America, are you?
No, you're not. I mean, somebody like that travels a long way.
Yeah.
But most people, as you said, never left their home village or their hometown. And the colossal consequences, and we saw with COVID, right? That, I suppose the Black Death is another example of that, isn't it? The spread, the way that things can spread so quickly.
But, I mean, again, the Black Death doesn't spread to America for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Whereas now it is. I think it's endemic in California, isn't it?
Is it really?
Yeah, I think so. Right. Plague is endemic there. Yeah.
Oh, my word. One last thing about the Columbus story. The Columbus story is really interesting because so many of these stories are not just about themselves. They're also about historiography and the way we talk about history and the way that the Columbus story has become so heavily moralized and is such a sort of lightning rod for political arguments. That stands for so many stories in history now. They're the subject of such fierce argument. And I think that's another good reason to have him. All right.
What are we on now? Are we on five?
Five.
We both absolutely agree with this one as well. And again, it may seem Eurocentric, but we're going to have to justify our Eurocentrism in choosing. Actually, we have two revolutions coming up. Mm-hmm. And they're both based not just in Europe, but in a particular corner of Western Europe. So we need to dig deep in justifying them, I think.
So this is a subject to which we'll be returning. We had it very excitingly. We had a whole evening with Theo in a Vietnamese restaurant where we planned the entire schedule for 2024. And this is the French Revolution. And in particular, this is the storming of the Bastille. So July 1789. And obviously we've chosen this, Tom, not because a sort of slightly simplistic argument would be, well, the French Revolution is a great turning point in history. You know, the French Revolution, you know, does this, that, and the other. But it's actually about the idea of revolutions. It's the idea about people resisting authority, kind of people power, people taking to the streets. And it's also the way in which people can be motivated by a single, by ideology. Because obviously that's what the French Revolution comes to symbolize. The idea of the revolution itself, of course, nationalism, all of those kinds of things.
The idea of the left and right.
The idea of left and right comes from the French Revolution. I can't remember if it's the National Assembly or the convention where people sat on different sides.
But we will have remembered by the time we do.
Undoubtedly, we will have remembered.
Pass ourselves off as great experts on it.
As always, Tom, as always. So yes, the French Revolution, I suppose you could argue that a European revolution was coming at some point. I mean, there was a revolution in 1830, the revolutions in 1848 that we talked about with Christopher Clark. But the French Revolution is the foundational moment. I suppose one question which our American listeners would undoubtedly ask, they'd say, yet again, you downplay the importance of the American Revolution. But the truth is the French Revolution is much more obviously dramatic, isn't it?
Dramatic, but also, I think, ideologically more important.
Yeah.
Because the American Revolution is, well, I mean, it's cast by the American revolutionaries as echoing a Roman prototype, the overthrow of the Roman king and its replacement by a republic. So in that sense, it's an ancient story, whereas the French Revolution, an ideologically driven rejection of the past, which is what it increasingly becomes, an idea that the past is something to be utterly repudiated, and that a bright new future by means of repudiating the past can be brought into existence. This is in itself a completely revolutionary idea. People hadn't really had that before.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to emphasize just how suspicious of change for its own sake most of human civilization has been. And we are now so habituated to it. The idea that, I mean, simply on the level of even the dullest, most conventional politician saying, I'm a radical, I'm in favor of radical change. I mean, Rishi Sunak was trying to do it, wasn't he?
Yeah, Keir Starmer.
Yes. I mean, they're both doing it. That idea that radical change is and of itself a positive, I think, is the global fruit of the French Revolution. And it is global because we have an image of Chairman Mao beaming over people carrying his little red book and bearing flanners and banners and all that. I mean, China, this ancient, sophisticated civilization, so kind of secure of itself, of course, now is a communist state, and communism is indisputably a fruit of the French Revolution.
Yeah. I think that idea of the past is sinful, the past is something that must be thrown aside, completely agree with you about the difference in the French and the American revolutions. Don't forget, in the American Revolution, the American colonists believed that they were preserving their ancient liberties.
Yeah.
They believed that it was King George and his
Magna
parliament
Carter and all that,
who were the modernizers, the radicals who were trying to change things, and it was to keep things as they were that they rebelled. Now, the French Revolution is completely different. And as you said, the very fact that they rename the months of the year, that they have the cult of the supreme being, they rename the years,
and they
year
rename
one of
their
the
king.
Revolution.
They rename their king. You know, Louis Capet, he becomes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's astonishing.
They change their names, Philippe Égalité.
Yeah.
All of that kind of stuff. They abolish slavery, Theo is very keen for us to say, because he's very pro-French Revolution. Yeah. Loves it. Loves the guillotine.
I mean, it's very, obviously very, very unsettling to Ancien Régime Europe. But I guess, you know, that there are intellectual trends within Europe that makes it come as not a complete surprise. But I think that China, you know, just going back to China, I mean, it is astonishing that China becomes communist, that China is kind of influenced by the impact of the French Revolution, because the whole essence of Chinese civilization, the kind of Confucian model, is of respect for elders, is of respect for tradition. And that gets utterly jettisoned by Mao and the Chinese Revolution. And it's kind of interesting, it's coming back now. You know, there's a...
Yeah.
President Xi is quite keen on a kind of Maoist Confucian fusion, which seems an impossible beast.
One other thing about the French Revolution, the idea of a tension between, as it were, the palace and the streets, between authority and protest, that's one that all regimes live under that shadow today. So
yes.
No matter, you know, so actually you mentioned President Xi. I mean, obviously what lies at the back of the minds of many of China's leaders is, you know, how do we keep this going? How do we stop a revolution in China? How do we... You know, we don't want the middle classes to become discontented or to become frustrated in the way that they were in France in the 1780s. So that, again, I mean, that wasn't really an issue to people in the, I don't know, the 12th century or something.
But also the French Revolution embodies the idea of liberty.
Yes.
So we also have the kind of the enduring impact of that. We had got the Berlin Wall being knocked down.
Yeah.
So if the French Revolution has inspired communism, it has also inspired anti-communism.
It has indeed. Exactly. The French Revolution is the foundational moment of conservatism.
It is. Yes.
Yeah.
But which isn't to say that the overthrow of the, you know, pulling down the Iron Curtain is inherently conservative. I mean, I don't think it is.
No, but the idea
of... it's reactionary. I mean, a communist would say it was reactionary, but I think that it's that idea that, and this again, I think, is why the storming of the Bastille has the incredible resonance it does, is that it's a prison and the doors are being flung open. And even though there weren't actually... Hardly anyone in the Bastille, but the idea of cell doors being flung open, of people who had been pent in being let free, I think that that's why the symbolism of the Berlin Wall coming down was so potent. It kind of expressed in photographic form impulses that explain why the Bastille is the iconic moment.
Actually, the fall of the Bastille, it's also a violent moment, Tom. So, and the violence unleashed by the revolution, you know, that is symbolized by the murder of the governor. I remember his head was sawn off by a butcher or something. Horrendous moment.
On a stick.
Horrendous moment. But that, again, can stand for the way in which ideology, in which the passion of the mob can unleash these forces.
Sure, absolutely. But just to reiterate, I think there is also a more positive way of framing it.
Madness.
Which is, I know.
Absolute madness.
I know you are the Burkean perspective on it. But there is the idea of liberty as a good, the idea of light being let into the darkness of a dungeon.
Yeah.
I think, and that this is a kind of motivating factor. I think that that is a crucial kind of legacy of the revolution. And another reason why we are legitimate in chalking it up as an iconic moment. So we've done five.
Yeah.
So that's the French Revolution, very significant. But there is, of course, another revolution
yeah.
brewing across the channel.
Very good, Tom. So you were very keen on these photos. So you talk about light and darkness. If for those people who can see the images that we were going to use on the live stream, my image for this is a painting called Coalbrookdale by Night by Philip James de Lutterborg, painted in 1801. It's a painting of the Ironbridge Gorge in Shropshire, my home county. And this is the birthplace, regarded in Britain as the birthplace of industry. So it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
So your count, your natal county.
My natal county is the most important place in the world.
of an iconic moment.
It is.
The Industrial Revolution.
So the Industrial Revolution, what you can see in the picture, if for those people looking at the picture, which is obviously 3% of the people listening to this, is a blast furnace called the Bedlam Furnaces. Bedlam, obviously, the idea of kind of pandemonium and the idea of that sort of unleashing hell, as it were. But the Industrial Revolution, Tom, is an absolutely transformative moment in world history, I think, for two reasons. Well, I mean, not just for two reasons, for a myriad of reasons. But here's one is obviously that in the long run, the forces that it unleashes, the economic forces, they prolong human life. They give people more opportunities, higher living standards, all of these things than ever before, often at a very high cost, it's fair to say. But, you know, you look at any graph of life expectancy, of people's wealth, all of these kinds of things.
And population growth.
Urbanization, all this stuff. But obviously, doing this podcast in 2023, as opposed to, let's say, 1983, we're so conscious now of the environmental costs of the Industrial Revolution. And in a way, you know, depending how things work out, obviously, lots of our listeners will have their own different views on this. But you could argue that maybe in the long run, for the planet, for humanity, the Industrial Revolution might actually be the most important event for ill rather than for, well, for ill and for good, let's say.
Yeah, so we also have an image of the rocket, which in 1830 made its kind of debut journey from Liverpool to Manchester.
That's steam train.
The steam train, and poor old Huskinson got run over on that.
One of the most amusing
trip.
One of the most amusing moments, I have to say, in the history. Yeah, the rest
of
history.
We did an episode on that. If you were, it was an invention of the railways. And I just wanted to include that because I'm sure I've mentioned it before. There was a brilliant documentary on Channel 4 called "The Day the World Took Off," and in a way, it was a documentary series that kind of embodies the idea behind this episode that there are. Symbolic moments that kind of resonate and spill out through history. And it began by focusing on the specific details of that day, and it ended up looking at the entire course of human civilization from the Neolithic up to the Space Age. And of course, in terms of the way that the Industrial Revolution has reverberated through the past two centuries, I mean, we are now standing on the brink, not just of the impact of industrialization on climate as a threat to humanity, but also just this year, the development of artificial intelligence kind of reaching a moment where people who really know about the subject are saying that it might be an existential threat to humanity.
Yeah.
So that's fun as well.
Or it's bigger leap. I mean, people, to take it back to your original thing, people have said, haven't they, AI is not the printing press. AI is farming or fire. It is a change of that magnitude, which actually, like, you know, people won't be surprised to hear that somebody who loathes change of all kinds. I find that terrifying because I kind of like the world as it is. But there's a brilliant book about the Industrial Revolution called Pandemonium. And this idea of unleashing this storm, this typhoon of economic and social change, really since the end of the 18th century, that has been the story of humanity, hasn't it? It's just constant, ever increasing, ever more dizzying and disconcerting change. And without the changes unleashed by the Industrial Revolution, things like Nazism, Marxism, the world wars, the sort of surging passion and violent passions of the 20th century, they would never have reached, I think, such a pitch. Don't you agree?
Well, I think what has made modernity has been the fusion of those two revolutions. The way that, I mean, it's kind of really striking that they're essentially happening at the same time.
Yeah.
The French and the Industrial, although maybe we should call it the British Revolution.
The British Revolution, very good.
That it's those that have essentially created the modern world. And it's kind of, people will have noticed that the closer we come to the present, the more we are bunching iconic episodes together. And people may feel that we're being guilty of presentism there, that because we're closer to them, we're kind of amplifying their significance. But I think that reflects the way in which the course of recent history has been one of dizzying acceleration.
Right, because, I mean, somebody who, a man from ancient Greece, from, you know, I don't know, 4th century BC, 5th century BC, Athens, if you dropped him in Europe in the 1100s, he would not say, my God, this is unfathomable. I mean, the technology would largely be familiar to him, even though it's more than a millennium away. Whereas you drop someone from 1750 into 1950, you know, they're completely disconcerted and they don't know what's going on. You know, they don't know how to use a telephone. I mean, these things sound like petty things. But the rate of change is technological change. I mean, you'd be a fool to deny that.
I mean, and that's
increased.
Kind of the power and the tragedy of, say, we're in Australia and we've just done some episodes on Captain Cook.
Yeah.
Of a ship like the Endeavour, which is the embodiment, you know, kind of very early embodiment of this process of industrialization, turning up off the shore where people are still in the Stone Age, where people are hunter-gatherers, as they had, you know, as people had been across the world for tens of thousands of years, really brings home the dislocating impact of these changes to the course of history.
Tom, we've got 5 minutes max. Theo is gesturing wildly behind your back.
So our final moment, iconic moment, is a man landing on the moon.
1969. Now, this is one where, again, people could conceivably be skeptical and they could say, hey, this was a massive technological cul-de-sac. You know, Kennedy made this pledge that we would land a man on the moon by the end of the 1960s for Cold War reasons. And we have not built a moon base. You know, we're not go out to establish colonies on Jupiter. So in other words, you could argue it's a very flashy and exciting gimmick in historical terms rather than a transformative moment. So Tom, why do you think it's so important?
Okay, so we got the iconic image of Neil Armstrong standing on the moon, but we also have the equally iconic image of the globe seen from space, the first photograph, the seas, the clouds, the continents set amid the vast blackness of space.
Yeah.
And I think that was hugely influential on giving people on the planet a kind of global perspective and also of the precariousness of it. So you're talking about how someone in 1972 might perhaps be less conscious of the retrograde impact of industrialization than someone now. But I think that actually 1972 is quite a good, you know, date to have chosen, because I think that the development of environmentalism and the green movement in the immediate wake of the moon landings is not a coincidence.
The idea of spaceship Earth, the idea of this sort of fragile ark lost in the darkness, and you know, everything has to be preserved and it's very delicate balance, and the idea of an ecosystem, the idea of an ecosystem,
that really
comes out of that sort of 1960s, 1970s period.
And what you also get in the 70s is an ambition to go beyond, not further than the moon, further than the solar system, out into the kind of the vastness of space. So you have Pioneer going out in 1972, with it's the iconic I can't remember what it was called, they kind of put a plate on it illustrating humanity with a man and a woman on it, and kindly letting any aliens know exactly where we are so that they can come and get it. And then there's Voyager in 1977, which has the golden records, which has Jimmy Carter.
What a terrible thought that is.
Saying howdy to Alpha Centauri and all that kind of messages and things like that. And I think it's Voyager that sends back the little blue dot, the little dot, isn't it, that Carl Sagan writes about. This kind of, it's the final image of Earth as just the tiniest little dot about to kind of vanish into the vastness of space. And I think that sense of our smallness before the face of the universe.
A cosmic insignificance,
Cosmic
Tom.
Insignificance puts our history into some form of perspective. But it also, as it has always done, serves as an incentive to travel and as a stage on which great figures can display and manifest their manhood.
So do you have a great figure in mind?
So our very final picture is of Jeff Bezos's rocket taking off.
Would you like to
describe the rocket?
The shape of that rocket. I mean, if you were being generous, you'd say it actually looks like the microphone that you're holding now. If you were being less generous, you would say
it's a massive cock. Which, bearing in mind it's Jeff Bezos's rocket,
Right.
Is only apt.
They're very nice. Yeah. Why is it shaped like that? Is that, has he done that? Is he showing off?
Who knows?
Surely you wouldn't construct a rocket for that. But so do you think, this is a ridiculous question because we're not the rest of space, but do you think these things are a cul-de-sac, or do you think one day our successors, you know, your great-great-great-great-grandchildren will be living on Jupiter or whatever?
As you say, we're not the rest of space, but I think we are sufficiently the rest of history to say that the impulses that our fascination with space and the technological investments that we as a species are making in it are expressive of factors that make human history explicable.
Do you know what, Tom? They're an expression of Alexander the Great's pathos.
Yes.
His yearning for something beyond.
Yes.
And Tom, I think on that bombshell, we're about to be kicked out of the hotel room, which is very disappointing because I know you'd like to talk for hours about this, wouldn't you, about Jeff Bezos's manhood.
Well, I'll tell you what I would like to do, just thinking about it. I would like to do an episode on, in the 70s, the idea of sending spaceships out into the inky reaches of space. What motivated that, okay, and what it says about America.
The space race would be a great subject. Yeah. And Tom, you know I'm always happy to do episodes about the 1970s.
I know.
But for those of you listening to this, when it comes out, we have JFK poised to appear on the rest of his history.
We have Windrush, don't we?
We have the Windrush, which is the ship that lands in Britain after the Second World War, bringing migrants from the Caribbean.
So that's out of this Friday, I think.
What else do we have? Theo's just doing the thumbs up, so it looks like we've got Donald Trump coming, but we actually haven't.
We have the mystery of the pregnant Pope coming.
The Tichborne Claimant, Tom.
The Tichborne Claimant, and we have my brother talking about the Second World War in Italy in 1943.
All right, so thank you very much for listening. We're very sorry to those of you who are hoping that it would be a live stream. Defeated by Australian technological ineptitude. What can we say? I noticed Brisbane getting a lot of grief actually on social media, Tom.
Yeah, a bit harsh, I think.
I think we were just making demands on the hotel Wi-Fi that were totally unreasonable. So on that bombshell, thank you very much for listening. Tom, brilliant list and lovely pictures.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.